From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Dave Chappelle. He's one of the funniest and highest paid acts on TV, so everyone noticed when he went temporarily MIA. The third season of his hit series Chappelle's Show was supposed to premiere last month, but Chappelle disappeared. He's back, the season is still on hold, and Chappelle-hungry fans can get their fix from the Chappelle Show Season 2 DVD, which just came out. Also, with an eye on the HBO program Entourage, critic-at-large John Powers looks at celebrities and the Entourage phenomenon. Then, we celebrate the 90th birthday of guitarist and inventor Les Paul. He's still performing. And film critic David Edelstein looks at the new Japanese animation film, Howl's Moving Castle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Dave Chappelle is one of the highest paid and most popular comics on TV right now. Except he isn't on TV right now. The third season of his Comedy Central series, called Chappelle's Show, was scheduled to start last month. But Chappelle pulled a vanishing act, retreating to South Africa and forcing the network to substitute other programming. There were rumors of drug abuse, mental instability, even a conversion to Islam. But Chappelle denied all of that in Time magazine and resurfaced last week at two comedy clubs in Los Angeles, dropping in unannounced to perform for delighted crowds. Chappelle says he was thrown by his sudden fame and unhappy with the direction his show was taking in its third season, so he pulled the plug. Neither he nor Comedy Central has announced when Chappelle's show will resume, but DVD sales of its first two seasons attest to his amazing popularity and success. The first season of Chappelle's Show has sold almost 3 million copies, making it the biggest-selling TV series on DVD ever released. It also means more people bought the show than watched it on Comedy Central, which is just plain astounding. The second season DVD of Chappelle's Show has sold half of that already, and it was released only 2 weeks ago. Terry spoke with Dave Chappelle last year during the second season of his show.
You said in one episode of your show that after someone complained to you that your show was offensive to black people, and that person, by the way, was white, you came up with this idea for a game show called I Know Black People.
I know black people!
Welcome to the show, I Know Black People. We take contestants who claim to know black people and put their knowledge of African-American culture to the test. The contestant who answers the most questions, of course, wins our grand prize. Let's bring them out one at a time now. Our first contestant is a professor of African American studies and history at Fordham University, the New York City police officer, is a writer for such black television shows as The Chris Rock Show and Chappelle Show. Okay, our next contestant works in a Korean grocery store, is a DJ, and claims to have many black... How can black people rise up and overcome?
How can they rise up and overcome? Oh, can they? No.
That is correct.
Reparations.
That is acceptable.
This is a rap lyric?
No, this is, I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a general question.
This is an actual question.
All right. There's a complex answer there.
That is correct.
Staying alive.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, stop cutting each other's throat.
That also is correct. How can black people rise up and overcome?
Get out and vote.
That is incorrect. I'm sorry.
Dave Chappelle, that's such a funny idea for a show. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the writing of the sketch, like what it was like to put this sketch together?
Originally, we were going to write the material. We were going to write it like an actual sketch. And when we sat down and started to write it, it was one of these things where it's like, this would be better if we got actual people and just quizzed them. And we just came up with questions. We just had them put
You actually
the set
got
together.
Real people. You got like a white cop.
All those people were real. We had them get us a police officer, get us a Korean grocer, get us a black dude.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, it was completely authentic. And then all the hosting elements were just like, as far as those were like off the cuff, you know. But the answers were incredible, man. The things that these people were saying. One of the things, they're going to see me, so they kind of go for being funny, but all of them were really nervous, and they were all kind of afraid that I was making fun of them. And then once we got to shooting, I think everyone just kind of relaxed and kind of unwound. And I don't know. That's one of my favorite sketches we've done.
Now, you grew up in different neighborhoods because, I guess this was because of your parents' divorce. If I understand correctly, you grew up in Silver Springs, Maryland, Yellow Springs, Ohio, because your father was teaching at Antioch College, which is located there, and Washington, D.C. You went to schools in these different places, too?
Yeah, I did elementary school in Silver Springs, middle school in Ohio, and high school in Washington.
were you almost part of like different cultures in those different places? Were there different ways of like dressing and different music that your friends listened to depending on which place it was, whether it was the suburbs or the city or Ohio or Washington?
I think elementary school was more integrated because, you know, people were younger. They mixed freely with black kids, white kids. Everybody was, you know, there was no real racial hangups in elementary school. And people weren't really clothes conscious because we were young. And then by the time I got to middle school in Ohio, that's when you start seeing alligators on people's sweater and people start getting into, like, status symbols and stuff. And that was the first time where I really started, like, hey, man, I'm poor. And, like, we don't have any money, do we? And then when I got to high school, so then I started getting into clothes. Then I go to high school and, you know, I was gone during middle school. Crack came out while I was gone. So I saw, like, the before and after picture. I had to piece the crack epidemic together. Like, I remember my first day of high school, and they were like, all right, look, if you have a pager on in school, then there's immediate grounds for suspension because we all know what that means. I was in the back like, I don't know what that means. And then, of course, I figured out that and then I was also trying to figure out how everyone had all this, like, gold and expensive stuff. And then I was like, oh, okay, everybody's selling drugs. I knew so many people in the beginning, like my freshman year of high school, that was selling drugs. I can't even imagine how many people were using them. You know, the crack epidemic was crazy, man. And I think a lot of the stuff that I did in my act, just coming from Ohio from... And then going straight back to D.C. during the crack epidemic, I think that all the inequities were just underlined.
So how did you change as you changed environments?
It's funny, man. When I was in Ohio, I was the first, like, real confident period of my life. Like, I started gaining confidence because for these kids, I was this outsider, and I had to make friends. And that was when I got, like, this huge reputation. Everyone was like, this guy's really funny. I remember in middle school, everyone was just like, this guy Dave is so hilarious. Then when I got to high school and the crack epidemic was out, you know, what it took to be popular during that, I just wasn't willing to do.
Which was what?
You know, sell drugs.
Like, right.
If you didn't have money, you couldn't get the girl you wanted, you know. It was a crack epidemic. Selling drugs was like a legitimate job in the high school I was going to. And all around D.C., it was like girls like drug dealers because they had money. I wasn't willing to be that. But it was kind of like that context kind of isolated me initially. And then when I started doing stand-up, it was like I thrived all over again.
So when you started doing stand-up and you were... still in high
14.
School? 14. Okay, in Washington. What were the jokes about? What was the humor about?
Man, the first act, Jesse Jackson was running for president, so I used to do jokes about that.
Like what?
I used to talk about stuff I saw on TV, like Alf. But they all had race in them, one way or another. Obviously, Jesse Jackson jokes gonna have some racial in them. Alf, my whole thing was like the alien comes 3 billion miles from space and gets a home with the white family. That was the paradox in that joke. Which all sounds corny now, but remember, I was 14, so it was like, wow, well, you know. What else was I talking about? All kinds of stuff. Like, in the very beginning, I didn't know that comedians had material. Like, I thought they just went up there and would just talk spontaneously. So I used to do the same thing, which is probably better that I started that way. Because that in and of itself is a skill that a lot of comedians are afraid to abandon their act. Once they get a good amount of time, they just want to stick to it.
So who were your audiences then?
All right, in those days in Washington, again, remember, this is a majority black city. There was no black comedy clubs. And I remember club owners saying things like, we'll never put more than one black person on a show. Because it offends the audience. I've heard all these things. In Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was pretty exclusive. There was one point where they actually had a rule that there was no more cursing on our stage. Which is like, this is in 88. And one of the comics who was black, this is pretty funny, he's like, look, man, he said, I curse. He said, black people use profanity because we live a profane lifestyle. And then he said something that I can't say on the radio. So he's basically like, if you see a roach crawling up the wall, you're not going to be like, golly gee, look at the roaches. You're going to be like, look at this motherfucking roach. You know, you're just gonna go for it. I know you're going to cut that out, but it was really funny, though. But just the fact, thinking back on it, the fact that there was all these limitations and all these weird issues that these club owners had, in one way, maybe it prepared me for television.
Dave Chappelle, speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with comic Dave Chappelle, whose second season of Chappelle's Show has just been released on DVD.
Now, you're really funny at doing white people. And I think, like, when you're white, you don't think of there being, like, a white accent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I hear you do it, I realize, okay, there's definitely, like, a white accent. So what do you do when you do white?
I take the rhythm out of my voice. I try to keep it monotone and even. But again, all right, see, I do these things, but I'm not really, it's almost like sometimes I'll watch old movies and how they portray black people, you know, with like Step and Fetch It and all these things. I remember watching them and something in the movie made me laugh and they were like, why are you laughing at that? And it's not that I'm laughing at black people as much as I'm laughing at the way black people were perceived. Like, this is what they actually thought about black people, which just seems ridiculous to me.
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, when I do that, I think, again, it's not malicious. And it's not necessarily what I think of white people. It's just a funny character of what, you know, what the world looks like through my eyes.
Is there a particular person you conjure up when you do a white man?
Not a particular, it's a composite character.
Of who?
It's funny, man. All right. You know, when I was growing up in D.C. in particular, this isn't true for me personally, but there's a lot of black people that I know who really had never had any personal experience with white people, mm-hmm. which is weird to think about in this day and time. But D.C. is a predominantly black city, and because of the economic situation and whatever, they just didn't have any contact with white people outside of being authority figures. Officer, your honor, you know, if it's a teacher or a principal, but it's always some kind of authority figure. You know, their experience with across the color line normally happened via television or something where you're dealing with an authority figure. So I, on the other hand, you know, my parents were split up. My mom was living in D.C., my dad was living in Ohio. I traveled to both places, so I was in the nation's capital on one end. I was in the heartland of America on another. So culturally, I kind of absorbed a lot.
I want to ask you another question about having grown up in three different places, suburban Maryland, suburban Ohio, and Washington, D.C.
Rural Ohio, and Washington.
Okay, so that exposes you to different people, different cultures, different kind of geographic landscapes, different ways of living. And I'm wondering if that helped give you the ability to kind of stand back and look at people and see what was kind of funny and ridiculous and absurd about all of us. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like you have that gift of just, like,
yeah,
looking back and standing outside and looking at everyone and seeing seeing some pretty funny things about us all.
Yeah, because most of the people that are stereotyped, I know the people that the stereotypes are based off of. Like, personally, I've met people like this. You know, I can remember friends of mine growing up, like, we used to all play football after school, and be like, it's four of us was black, two of us was Vietnamese, was a Jewish guy from the Deep South. it was an eclectic group, you know, but we all got along. We all, you know, were friends. In the household I grew up in, my parents were somewhat, I don't know how to explain it, but over our mantelpiece there was pictures of Malcolm X. You know, I listened to Dick Gregory records growing up. I listened to The Last Poets. I mean, you know, there were books of all over the house and always reading stuff. So like, you know, like people like Frederick Douglass. I you know, these guys' pictures were on my walls when I was growing up.
You described your family growing up as the broke Huxtables.
Yeah, we were like broke Huxtables.
Your mother was is a Unitarian minister?
She was, yeah. She was, I believe she was the first black woman ordained in that Unitarian church.
And your father was a music professor?
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Voice. He used to sing opera and stuff.
So your family was really very educated and probably instilled those values in you. Was there pressure on you to do well in school and what you really wanted was to be a comic?
I mean, first of all, I was a horrible student. My parents, you know, my dad was very philosophical about these kind of things. As a matter of fact, I'm the first person in my family not to go to college, like since slavery. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, didn't like that at all. She, at first, because I was 17, I'm like, I'm not going to college. I'm going to move to New York and try to make it and stand up. And she kind of flipped out. She was like, it's a dream of mine. This is a heavy guilt trip. She goes, it's a dream of mine to see all of my grandbabies graduate from college before I die. It's like, well, I got to bring Diane up, Nana. That's a lot of pressure. But then my dad's whole take on it was, unless you want to do something that requires you go to college, then college could very well be a waste of your time.
And he was a college professor, so coming from him, that must have really registered on you.
Yeah, he was an educator. He was an educated man. And I think my parents ultimately wanted me to be happy. You know, I mean, my argument was, you know, Dad, if you're making a teacher's salary, if I can make a teacher's salary doing stand-up, to me, I'd rather do that than teach. It's like, and he understood where I was coming from. Like, you know, it's like I didn't necessarily have to be rich and famous. Obviously, I wanted to. But that wasn't necessarily my aim. I just really, 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 to this day, I really like doing stand-up.
Since you started when you were so young, your mother had to, did she have to or did she just want to come to the clubs with you? Was that required as like an official chaperone because you were underage?
Originally, she had to. Once everyone started knowing me, this was kind of like our routine. We'd meet down at the club. I'd be coming from school. She'd be coming from work. It was cool, man. It was like a good way to spend time together. And then at a certain age, like maybe a year into it, you know, she'd get tired at night. We'd both burn the candle both ends, but I'd always want to go, so she just let me go. And you know, not until I'm an adult, then she tells me how scary that was for her.
In what way?
You know? I mean, she tells stories like she'd hear gunshots in the middle of the night. And, you know, she went, oh, my God, it's my baby. All right. I mean, remember, this is D.C. during the crack epidemic. But I guess in her mind, it's like of all the bad things that my child could be doing, he just wants to tell jokes at these clubs. And it was a controlled environment for me. It's not like the bartender's going to give me drinks. I'm 14. It's, you know, everyone kind of looked out for me. It wasn't like I saw stuff going on, but not really. It was really goal-oriented, the time I was spending there.
Well, Dave Chappelle, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
All right. No problem. It was good to meet you.
Dave Chappelle, speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. Here's another clip from the just-released second season DVD of Chappelle's show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Good evening, and welcome to the first and maybe only racial draft here in New York City. Folks, this is for all the marbles. What happens here will state the racial standing of these Americans once and for all.
That's right. And the crowd is here to support their races.
Well, Rob, some of the biggest names in sports and in entertainment are on the line tonight, and I'm excited to see who's going to be drafted by which race. Seated behind me on the stage there are the various representatives, and believe it or not, the blacks have actually won the first pick.
Wow, that's the first lottery a black person's won in a long time, Billy.
Yes, and they'll probably still complain.
Man, you. Well, the black representative is heading to the microphone now. Why don't we take a listen?
I'm in the black delegation. Tiger Woods.
No surprises there, fellas. The richest and most dominant athlete in the world. His father, black. His mother, Thai. Well, it doesn't matter anymore because now he is officially black. Dave, the Asians have got to be upset.
There's no question about that, Robert, but you gotta think about it. He's been discriminated against in his time. He's had death threats, and he dates a white woman. Oh. Sounds like a black guy to me. Tiger's taking the stage now, and if you ask me, he's looking blacker already.
I'd like to say it's a tremendous opportunity for me to finally be part of a race, have a home. Been so confused if I'm cab or collation, so many things. So long, fried rice. Hello, fried chicken.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Madame Bovary's Ovaries, A Darwinian Look at Literature by David and Nanelle Barash. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, you're nobody in show business until you're surrounded by nobodies. Critic at large John Powers looks at celebrities and their entourages. Also, we'll celebrate the 90th birthday of guitar legend Les Paul, and film critic David Edelstein looks at Howl's Moving Castle.
Don't cry, bye-bye
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. The HBO series Entourage began its second season last Sunday. The show revolves around a young, up-and-coming Hollywood star and his three parasitic buddies. The first season is out now on DVD. Critic at large John Powers saw the premiere and has these thoughts.
The other day, I was waiting in a long line at the post office, and it occurred to me that it would sure be nice if somebody else was doing it for me. In fact, wouldn't it be great if I had people to do all the unpleasant stuff that wastes so much of my life? Maybe you've had this thought, too, from time to time. I remembered it when I watched last Sunday's season premiere of Entourage, the HBO comedy about a handsome young movie star, Vince, who lives with and supports three buddies. There's Yammering Turtle, the heavy lifter, who drives them around L.A. and makes sure they have New York pizzas and cable. There's Brainy Eric, the manager, who spends his life saying things to people that the conflict-averse Vince doesn't want to say. And then there's Johnny, Vince's less successful brother. Kevin Dillon's great in this role, by the way. His insecurity about his acting career and his dependence on his brother's stardom lets Vince feel good about himself. Entourage has been hailed for capturing the subculture of Hollywood hangers-on. But I'm especially fascinated by Vince. He never has to wait at the post office, which leaves him free to be boyish, spontaneous, and affably above it all. His friends serve as a kind of protective, free-floating ectoplasm, the filter between him and the outside world. When Vince's agent Ari, played by Jeremy Piven, gets mad at Vince, he delivers his ultimatum to Eric.
I don't want this to get to a place where you start blaming me for everything. You guys don't listen to me. Listen to this. You tell your boy to do Aquaman, or you tell him to find other representation.
Faced with this threat, Eric must choose whether to pass it on, and if so, how to do it. After all, it's in Eric's interest, in the whole entourage's interest, to keep their meal ticket happy, but also successful. Although breezy and glib, Entourage is also quite timely in its evocation of an increasingly common feature of modern America. The way the rich, famous, and powerful are buffered from the demands and frictions of everyday life. The problem, of course, is that such a cocoon too often filters out reality itself. Lately, the media has been buzzing about whether Tom Cruise has damaged his career by seeming to go, well, slightly bonkers. Not only has he begun spouting his Scientological beliefs, even slamming Brooke Shields, the poor dear, for taking an antidepressant, there was that recent appearance on Oprah when he genuflected, jumped on the sofa, and declaimed his love for the actress Katie Holmes. While such behavior is undeniably weird, what's even weirder is that Cruise may not have known it's weird. He reportedly doesn't read newspapers or use the computer, but gets his information from his entourage, which carefully monitors what he hears. No doubt they're the ones who urged him to do that self-mocking sofa jump on Leno the other night. A piece of calculated damage control. Now, a movie star's antics are small potatoes. But the entourage situation becomes trickier when you reach political leaders. This is most flagrantly obvious in the case of dictators like Saddam Hussein. If a member of his claque said something Saddam didn't want to hear, you know, like the nuclear program wasn't going as well as planned, the guy was likely to wind up dead. The same is true, although less ruthlessly, in American politics. I was recently reading about the inner circle of Senator Hillary Clinton and learned that only one member, Maggie Williams, dared give the former First Lady advice. Or take President Bush. After his first debate with John Kerry, in which he made faces and seemed unexpectedly snappish, even conservative commentators speculated that this was partly because he'd spent too much time talking exclusively to underlings who want to please him. He simply wasn't used to being in a room with somebody who would criticize his policies or claim he was flat out wrong. Like the rest of us, the powerful need to hear the bad news. Unless, of course, they've been indicted. Take the case of Kenneth Lay, the former chairman and CEO of Enron, who insists that he's not responsible for his company's malfeasances. He was simply enjoying the good life and leaving the messy side of things to his retinue. He himself was completely out of the loop. I don't know whether or not a jury will believe that, but I do know this. A CEO whose defense is essentially that he's out of touch with the world around him needs to spend much less time in Learjets with yes-men and more time waiting at the post office. Why, heck, I'd even be willing to let him stand in line for me.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Coming up, guitarist Les Paul. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, guitarist and inventor Les Paul celebrated his 90th birthday.
Hi. Hello, folks. Let's see, I've got my guitar, I got my wife, Mary.
Hi.
And I got a room just loaded with electronics. We've got some inventions here that make one voice sound like many voices and one guitar like many guitars. And by means of these 6L6s and plugging them into this amplifier, why, we managed to...
Let me tell him, Les. You're a genius.
Oh, don't embarrass me.
Oh, yes, you are. Anyone who can take one guitar and make it sound like six is a genius.
No, you just say that because I'm your husband. That isn't true.
No one else can even play like you, much less make it sound like six people.
No, I like to play the guitar, but more than that, I like to get on the floor with a screwdriver and a lot of these gadgets and just tinker. That's
but you're
all.
A genius.
No, I'm just a big tinker.
Okay, so you're just a big tinker.
Oh, I should have taken my screwdriver and left while I was ahead. How did I get swindled into this?
Well, why don't you grab a guitar and show the people what you can do?
All right, I got a lot of ideas. Here we go. Now, that's one guitar. Now, if you want two, I just throw a switch.
How about three?
Easy. Now, if you want four, switch.
How about five?
It's a cinch. Now, if you want six, here's a half a dozen of easy ones.
Les Paul has spent his life playing guitar, inventing guitars to play, and inventing devices to record himself on. And at 90 years old, he hasn't quit his night job. He still performs weekly at the Iridium Jazz Club in New York and has several projects and other performances in the works. Les Paul has been called the Thomas Edison of music. For starters, he invented the solid-body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multi-tracking. Inventions that help make rock and roll and modern recording possible. But Paul himself has stuck to jazz and more middle-of-the-road pop. In the 1950s, he had several hits with his wife Mary Ford, such as How High the Moon, Vaya Con Dios, and Bye Bye Blues, all of which are included on a collection of classic Capitol masters which has just been reissued. Terry Gross spoke with Les Paul in 1992 when he was 76 years old. They started with his 1948 recording of Lover, recorded in his garage, which he said was the first recording to combine all his inventions and recording techniques into one bag of tricks.
On Lover, the high, fast, trebly sounds that we hear, that's a sped-up guitar?
Mm-hmm. Along with the normal guitar, the whole idea there is to be able to get octaves and to go an octave below and an octave above and to do all the harmony parts and everything, you know. And that was not the very first record I ever made that way, but like I say, it was the first. That was the first one to come out. And that came out about a week after I had an automobile accident where for 2 years I was to be in the hospital in a basket. everything I had was broken, and I was in bad shape for about 2 years. So I had a lot of time to think, and I unfortunately... didn't have that many records in the can, so to speak. What I had are records that were completely done except for the last part, which was the melody. And the reason I left that melody off is I figured that every week that went by, I got better. And if I got better, why, I had newer ideas. And so I'd leave that last part off. And after the automobile accident, I had to do the next recordings in a cast, a body cast. And that's how I made the parts for the next four or five records.
Now, let me get to one of the hits that you had. Let's talk about How High the Moon, which you recorded with Mary Ford, one of your big hits.
Thank you.
Let's hear some of it.
Where there's music, I'll paint the tune. Where there's heaven, how high the moon.
did you record Mary's voice to get that echo?
Well, that was something that I spent 2 years trying to find out. I didn't want reverb like an empty room. I didn't want Carnegie Hall. I didn't want that sound. I said to my friend, very dear friend, he and his girlfriend, Mary was my girlfriend, and myself, and a fellow named Wally Jones, we were all sitting in a little tavern at Santa Monica and Western out in Hollywood, and Lloyd was arm wrestling with me, and we had a pitcher of beer and some popcorn, and we're watching the fights on Friday night. And he pulled my arm down really easy, and he says, "Les, you're not concentrating. You're usually pretty rough to bring that arm down on." And I said, "Well, I'm thinking of that echo." And I said, "I haven't figured that delay out yet. I haven't figured it out." And he says, "Well, you still worried about that thing?" And I says, "Yeah, I need it, and I don't know how to get it." And he says, "Well, explain it to me again." And so this night, I explained it to Lloyd again. I says, "Picture that you're on the Alps." And I say, "Hello, hello, hello, hello." And I said, I want it to repeat, and I want the delay and the decay, I want to be able to vary it. And lo and behold, he says to me, "You mean like putting the playback head behind the record head?" Oh, boy, I threw $10 down on the table, and I said to Wally, "Pay the bill and bring the girls," you know. And we left him with the $10 bill and the girls, and the beer and the popcorn and the TV were gone. And by the time they got home, you could hear all over the neighborhood, "Hello, hello, hello, hello," you know. And we'd found the echo, the delay.
You know what I want to know? Why did you want to have echo on her voice?
That's interesting, because I felt as though when you play the note dry, just dead, it just drops like a rock, and it ends right there. And a lot of times you'd like to have that note hang on after you've left it and go to the next note. And it's very similar to ambience in a room, the sound of a room, where it's enhanced by bare walls. If I happen to be talking to you and I happen to be in a very empty room, you could recognize that riding in your car, listening at home. You say, "Well, I can tell that these people are talking in a very empty room." Or you can say they're talking in a phone booth. It's so small. Or it's a very large hall. So you have command over what you wish to do. And in this case, I didn't want that note to say, "Hey," and just go on like Carnegie Hall. I wanted to go, "Hey, hey." See? And now, if you want, you put a little tail on it. You go, "Hey, hey, 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 hey." You know? it gives you such command of so many things, the toys to work with. Today, they're not, I call them toys because the kids, they have all these little boxes that you can go in and buy in the store. When I was a kid and I visualized this thing, the reason I had to invent it is because you couldn't buy it in a store. So if I wanted it, I had to make one.
Les Paul is joining us from one of the studios in his home. I understand that you have arthritis of the fingers. How do you play?
Well, after my heart surgery in 1980, they just said, "Well, you're going to have to do something else because you can't play. Your hands are gone." And I only had a couple of fingers on each hand then. Now I have no fingers in the right hand that move. They're fixed. And so there's no movement except at the knuckles. And in the left hand, I only have two fingers, really one and a half, because the first finger is half frozen and painful. What do I do? I just have figured out that if I could do that, whatever I did then, I just figure out how to do that with two fingers. And so what I have done is, I says, well, what I used to do with two hands and all my fingers, I'm sure it can be done. And lo and behold, it can be.
So you've really taken the same approach to your body as you've taken to designing instruments and engineering equipment.
Oh, are you? You're great. You're great. Terry, you're great. The key to that is that the same will, the same power that you have to destroy yourself, you can use to make yourself well. If you have arthritis, you just have to have an iron jaw, and you got to go in there and not use any cop-out that, well, I can't play anymore because of the arthritis. You just say, there's a way. And I think that determination, I think that, and of course, you have to have a lot of luck, and you have to have the right genes and all that jazz to go with it. But I think the bottom line is that if you want to hard enough, you can do it.
You know, if I didn't know that you were telling me the truth, I would think that you were really crazy and exaggerated a lot.
No.
You've done so many remarkable things in one life.
Yeah, that I have. I wonder why that is. I woke up today thinking about it because in an interview they asked me what I wanted on my tombstone. I thought about it a minute, and I said, I guess I'd put on there, why me?
Do you feel like you were chosen?
I don't know. I just say, you know, I just happened to be around at that time, and there wasn't an electric guitar, so I built one, and there wasn't an echo, so I made one. There wasn't a multi-track machine, so I built one. It goes all the way back to, Terry, if I can really take you way back, it's the first time that my mother in her home had a radio, a Victrola, okay? That's the gramophone, that's the phonograph, okay? And a player piano. And I'm sitting there with all these things. And I looked at it and I says, you know, there's something interesting here. This piano, I can punch a hole in it wherever I wish, and that note will come out. And I can slow it down and speed up, and it doesn't change pitch. Okay, it just gets slower or faster. If I put my hand on a phonograph record and I slow it down, the pitch changes. Why? And that's the key to the whole thing, that curiosity of that you just asked that question, why? And you got your life cut out for you.
Well, Les Paul, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Les Paul speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. Les Paul turned 90 years old this week. The JVC Jazz Festival will celebrate his birthday during a special Carnegie Hall concert featuring Les Paul on June 19th. He continues his regular Monday night performances at the Iridium Jazz Club in New York. He's working on a new collaborative CD with Eric Clapton, Sting, Jeff Beck, Richie Sambora, and Peter Frampton. And a collection of his classic Capitol recordings has just been reissued.
Somewhere there's music, a favorite tune. Somewhere there's heaven, oh, high the moon. The darkest night would shine if you would come to me soon. Until you will, I'll steal my heart.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new animated film, Howl's Moving Castle. This is Fresh Air.
the Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki has a new film called Howl's Moving Castle. He's best known to American audiences for his award-winning film Spirited Away. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Is Hayao Miyazaki the greatest animator in the world? Other animators bow down before his drafting board, and in Japan, his movies outgross Star Wars. Films like Kiki's Delivery Service, My Neighbor Totoro, Princess Mononoke, and the Academy Award-winning Spirited Away are transporting, as well as profoundly strange. They feature creatures both ordinary and bizarre. They're full of flabbergasting flying machines that carry their industrious young heroines into another realm. And they're set in a nature that's not just alive, but infused with spirits. Miyazaki's latest film, Howl's Moving Castle, is based on a novel by England's prolific fantasy writer Diana Wynne Jones, but the director has made the story his own. The movie is a difficult work, a tough sell, beginning like a fairy tale and evolving into a bleak anti-war movie with demons both internal and external. It's as if Miyazaki has wedded his enchanting coming-of-age parable, Spirited Away, to his ferocious allegory of the end of nature, Princess Mononoke. The heroine is the timid and shy Sophie. She lives in a newly industrialized English town where enemy warplanes buzz overhead and demons roam the countryside. Sophie makes hats and fears she'll grow old behind her sewing machine. Even when she has a fantastical encounter with a dashing young man in which he whisks her through the air to escape some slithering shadow blobs in straw hats, she can't bring herself to get her hopes up. Then an immensely fat woman with chins under chins enters her shop. You'll recognize the fat woman's voice as Lauren Bacall's, while Sophie is the delightful Emily Mortimer.
I'm sorry, but the shop's closed now, ma'am.
What a tacky shop. I've never seen such tacky little hats. Yet you're by far the tackiest thing here.
The door was over here, ma'am.
Standing up to the wit of the waist, that's plucky. My regards to Howl.
The witch has cast a spell, turning Sophie into the withered crone she feared she'd become. So she trudges into the wild and hitches a ride with Howl's Moving Castle. It's an amazing, ramshackle vision, huge, with taloned feet, chimneys belching smoke, ladders and propellers and fins and portholes like eyes. It's studded all over with little houses. It's not alive, but it's infused with life by a fire demon called Calcifer. He's cursed to remain in a fireplace in the parlor of the dreamboat wizard Howl, who turns out to be the young man Sophie met in town. Of course, Howl doesn't recognize the 90-year-old woman, whose curse won't allow her to say who she really is. She goes to work as his housekeeper, or rather, moving castle keeper. Miyazaki's villains are often enemies of nature, and the focus of Howl's Moving Castle shifts from Sophie's curse to the war that's raging, with shark-like planes raining bombs on the countryside. The drama is in whether Howl, who behaves like a moody rock star, can pull himself together and use his magic to end the war. It turns out that his feelings have been muddled by a curse of his own. Everyone in this picture has a curse. The ins and outs of war are hard to follow, and it's tough to keep track of Howl's mood swings, which make parts of him deliquesce into green goo. But there's no mistaking the emotion that powers Miyazaki's imagery. As the once fearful Sophie finds the courage to draw Howl out of his despair, her features transform, now young, now old, now something tremulously in between. The English soundtrack is surprisingly soulful. It features Christian Bale as Howl, Gene Simmons as old Sophie, and the delicious Blythe Danner as the King's Head Sorceress. The one mistake is making Calcifer Billy Crystal. He tries to suppress his borscht belt inflections, but he's just too familiar for a tale this wondrously weird. Miyazaki's movies have a different tempo than the American animated features with vocals by the likes of Crystal and other jabbering showbiz personalities. Even with all the hairpin reversals, they're steady and contemplative. For all their outlandishness, they make us feel as if we're seeing deeper into reality. Miyazaki wants us to think, I dream, therefore I am.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What is the value of a human life? On the next Fresh Air, Kenneth Feinberg. He was in charge of calculating just how much the families of victims of the September 11th attacks would receive from the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund. Also, actor Christian Bale. He's Batman in the new movie Batman Begins. Join us for the next Fresh Air.